Plate.com. Make affordable crowd-pleasing meals at home. Choose from 14 delicious and affordable recipes that change every week. Everything you need is shipped to your door. Home-cooked deliciousness, nearly in 30 minutes. Save time and skip tedious trips to the grocery store. Save money and enjoy tasty dinners that won't break the bank at only $4.99 per serving. Easy-to-cook recipes that only six simple steps and will turn you into a chef. And you can skip or cancel anytime. Some of the meals are sweet chili chicken, super smash burgers, balsamic glazed pork chops, Tuscan pork meatballs, crispy blue chicken, cheese chicken, chicken sausage meatball soup, sausage chicken and pepper stir fry, garlic and white sauce, flatbreads, caramelized onion meatloaf, loaded baked potato chowder, creamy chicken sausage penne and black bean and pepper, jack tostadas, chili garlic soup, crispy chickpea couscous, 6 chicken breasts, ground beef, and 4 chicken breasts. Just select this recipe after signing up. Recommended by 9,000 families. Break the cycle of boring. Good morning. Here is Chapter 16 of American Dirt by Neen Cummins. The joke at home had always been that Luca and Sebastian shouldn't talk to Lydia until she was well into her second mug of morning coffee. She always had 2 at home and a 3rd in the shop when she opened. She got into the habit of cleaning the filters and filling the craft at night so she wouldn't have to contend with all that in the morning. When she was still half asleep, it was the first thing she did each day when her alarm went off. On her way to the bathroom, she'd flip the power switch on the coffee maker and feel a gurgle of happy impatience when red light came on. On Sundays when she had extra time, she'd steam milk for froth or brew the grounds with cane sugar and cinnamon for cafe de ola. Now there's no coffee at all most mornings, which triggers a daily headache when it made worse when Lydia's exhausted from lack of sleep. They return to the tracks early and there are a dozen or so other migrants gathered there waiting for the train. Nearby, a man wearing nice jeans and a clean collared shirt stands at the back of a pickup truck with the tailgate folded down. Inside there's a huge pot of rice and a cooler stacked with steaming tortillas. He's the padre from the trackside church with the pennant flag, and before he feeds the migrants, he offers them communion and gives a blessing. Then he fills the tortillas with the rice and hands them out. He also has a big orange barrel that says Gatorade enough, even though it's fruit punch. One of the other migrants spills paper cups and hands them around to whoever's thirsty. Lydia and the girls sit on one of the benches and eat in silence. It's Luca who notices. Why are they waiting on that side of the track? He points. Now Lydia says, chewing. The migrants are gathered on the southbound side. Rebecca takes her tortilla with her as she walks over to the waiting men. She speaks with them and then returns to explain. We've missed the Pacific route, she says. What? So that sounds a lot. Not by much. Don't worry. Rebecca sits back down beside her sister. Only an hour south of here is Celaya. The third largest city is the state of Guanajuato. Luca interjects quietly. Both girls turn to gawk at him. He slurps his fruit punch, embarrassed. Rebecca tells so we can ride the train south and change at Celaya for the Pacific route. But why? Lydia asks, sitting forward. Isn't it shorter if we go this way? It's not safe, Rebecca says. Our cousin told us. Everyone told us. Soledad corrects her. Everyone told us we have to take the Pacific route. All the other routes are super dangerous because of the cartels. The food is pasty in Lydia's mouth. Everyone says the same thing, Soledad agrees. Only the Pacific route is safe. Lydia doesn't need to be convinced, but she does have a question. The girls seem to know a lot more than she does. Do you know which cartels run which routes? No, but God is watching out for us, Rebecca says. She makes a sign of the cross. We will be okay. Just to make sure, the sisters go into the church to light a candle while they wait. When the southbound train comes through San Miguel de Allende, it doesn't stop, but it's traveling slowly, and the gathered men all board with ease. Luca watches sisters jog alongside beside the train. Their fear makes them graceful and strong, their movement precise. Men wait at the top of the ladder to grab their hands and haul them onto the roof. Luca will not be left behind. He runs and Mamie with him. He feels very brave, gentle, just at the moment when he grabs onto the advancing ladder and the cursory vibration echoes into the palm of his hand and all down into the bones of his body, and that reverberation reminds him how small he is and how colossal the train is and how dead he would be if he let go at the wrong time. Mammy's behind him and she boosts him from the backside, and he grips the ladder so hard his knuckles turn colors, and he's almost afraid to let go with one hand so he can climb up to the next rung. But he knows he must, because he has to make room for Mammy, so he climbs on fear, and the fear is like a balloon in his throat. But now there are two men at top, and one reaches down and grabs him by the backpack and the other by his upper arm, and he's now on top of the train, and Rebecca's smelling him, and here comes Mammy over the ledge. They did it. Que macizo chiquito, Rebecca is impressed. He grins. Luca has never liked a girl before. Okay, this time it's not the truth, because he... because he liked Daredevil Pilar from school, because she was really good at football. And he liked his cousin Yennefer because she was nice to him like 85% of the time, even when she was mean to her brother. And he liked this one girl, Miranda, who lived in the same apartment building, because she wore bright yellow sneakers that could make her tongue into the shape of a shamrock. So maybe it was more accurate to say that Luca's never been in love before. On top of the train, Luca watches Rebecca and tries to act like he's not watching Rebecca. Not that anyone would notice anyway, because everybody's too busy watching Soledad to notice anything else. In the half light left over from Soledad's corona, Rebecca glimmers like a secret sun. She's stretched out on her back next to Luca on top of the train. So why'd you guys leave home? She asks him. Luca grinds his teeth and tries to formulate an answer quickly before she can feel bad for having asked, but he can't think of anything to say. You're running from your dad, she guesses. No, Luca says. Pappy was great. He rolls onto his side so he can look at her even more, though that means his arm is no longer stretched alongside hers. Are you a spy, she asks. I won't tell anyone, I swear. She's holding a piece of carpet over her face for shade, and her black hair is all looped through the holes in the metal grate beneath him. Yes, Luca says. I'm a spy. My government received a tip about a nuclear warhead on this train. I'm here to save the universe. Thank God, it's about time, Rebecca laughs. The universe needs saving. The train rocks uneven beneath them. Nearby, Mammy chats quietly with Soledad. What about you, he asks. Why did you leave home? Sigh, Rebecca frowns. She actually says the word suspiro instead of sighing, which is funny despite the unhappiness of her expression. Everything was bad in the end, she says. Soledad is super pretty, you know. She lifts the cardboard to the side of her face where the sun is. Is she? I didn't notice, Luca says. I guess so, Rebecca laughs, and uses the cardboard to swat him on top of the head. Anyway, we come from a really small place, only a little scrap of a village in the mountains, or not even a village, really, because of how stretched out it is. Just a collection of different tucked away places where people live, and it's a really out of the way place. The city people call it a cloud forest, but we just call it home. Why cloud forest? Luca asks. Rebecca shrugs. I guess because of all the clouds. Luca laughs. But every place has clouds. Now, I like this, Rebecca says. In my place, the clouds are not in the sky. They're on the ground. They live with us in the yard, sometimes even in the house. Wow. Rebecca has smiled. It was always soft there, enchanted. And there was no cell service or electricity in the house or things like that. And we lived there with our Mamie and Pepe and Abuela. But it was pretty impossible to make a living in that place because there was no work, you know. Luca nods. So our papi, it was mostly a way of living all the time in the city in San Pedro Sula. In his head, Luca thinks, San Pedro Sula, second largest city in Honduras. 1.5 million people, murder capital of the world. Out loud, he says. Are you a Honduran? No, Rebecca corrects him. Chorti. Luca makes a face into a question. Indian, she explains. My people are Chorti. Luca nods, even though he doesn't really understand the difference. Anyway, Pepe was a cook in this big hotel, San Pedro Sula, and it was almost a 3-hour journey by bus from where we lived, so he only came home maybe once every couple of months to visit us. But that was still okay, because this place, our little club for us, was, even though we missed our Pepe, it was the most beautiful place you'd ever seen. He didn't really know that then, because it was the only place we'd ever seen, except in pictures and books and magazines. But now that I've seen other places, I know how beautiful it was, and we loved it anyway, even before we knew, because the trees had these enormous dark green leaves as big as a bed, and they would sway in the wind. And when it rained, you could hear the big fat raindrops splatting under those giant leaves, and you could only see the sky in bright blue patches if you were walking along ways off to a friend's house or to a church or something. When you passed through a clearing and all those leaves would pack back away and open up, and the hot sunshine would beat down all yellow and gold and sticky, and there were waterfalls everywhere with the big rock pools where you could take a bath, and the water was always warm and it smelled like sunlight, and at night there was a sound of the tree frogs and the music of the rushing water from the falls and all the songs of the night birds, and Mamie would make most delicious chilote, and her brother would sing to us in an old language and sold out, and I would gather herbs and dry them and bundle them for paper to sell in the market when he had a day off, and that's how we passed our days. Look, I can see it. He's there far away in the misty cloud forest in a hut with a packed dirt floor and a cool breeze with Rebecca and Soledad and their Mamie and Abuela. And he could even see the father far away down the mountain and through the streets that clogged the enormous city, wearing a long apron and a chef's hat and his pockets full of dried herbs. Look, I can smell the wood of the fire, the cocoa and cinnamon of the chilote. And that's how he knows that Rebecca is magical, because she can transport him 1,000 miles away into her own mountain homestead just by the sound of her voice. The clouds were so thick that you could wash your hair in them, she says. But then one day something awful happened, because we were so isolated up there in a place. So when the narcos came through and all the men from the village were gone away into the city for work, those bad men would do whatever they wanted. They could take whatever girls they wanted for themselves, and there was no one there to stop them. Luca blinks hard at her. He doesn't want to experience this part. He's suddenly just like Rebecca's easy magic. The way he can feel those men barging through the forest, their streaming bodies vaporizing the clouds around them as they swipe and stomp their way through the undergrowth. But he can't stop himself from asking the questions. Those bad men, they took you? No, Rebecca makes a kind of face that reveals all her straight white teeth, but it isn't a smile, not at all. We were lucky because we heard the scream coming from our neighbors because of the way those clouds could trap and funnel the sound even from far away. So we stopped the fire from making it smoke and we hid. They never found our place. Oh, look, it feels relieved. But then after they were gone, we discovered what had happened and that they'd taken 4 girls from our side of the mountain with them. Our Mamie decided that very day that sold out and had to leave that place, even though it was the only place we knew in the world. We didn't want to leave it. Luca can feel his face crumbling for her, and he tries to arrange it into an expression of comfort instead of pain. So the next day, Mamie walked Soledad and Emmy down the mountain, and she put us on the bus to San Pedro Sula. Wait, what? She didn't go with you? Rebecca draws her knees up in front of her and fans herself with the cardboard. She shakes her head. She said nobody would bother 2 old ladies, so she and Abuela stayed behind. Luca swallows. She doesn't want to ask the next question, but he does. What happened to them? I don't know. I haven't seen them since that day. We got to the city. We found a Pepita's hotel, and we stayed with them in an apartment. It was just a room. It was awful there. So bright and hot and loud, because there was always noise from cars and radios and televisions and people. But Pepe said we were safer anyway. He liked having us with him, even though we ever saw him, because he was working all the time, and he wanted us to start going to school. Well, school's the same there as it was back home, Rebecca is satisfied. No, look, nothing was the same. She turns to look over her shoulder at Soledad, but we tried to make the best of it anyway. We never had much schooling at home, or only when we were little, so it was hard for us to catch up, and there wasn't any other Indios there, so we felt out of place. We hoped to take the bus back up the mountain some weekends with Pappy so we could visit with Mamie and Abuela and our friends, so we could go up the clouds and refill our spirits. But weeks and then months went by, and Papi was always working, and we never had extra time or money for the bus. And then Sola accidentally got a boyfriend. Luca holds up one hand. Wait, how do you accidentally get a boyfriend? Rebecca says, don't let her hear you. Luca drops his voice, leans closer, but now like she was walking home one day by herself, and this boy noticed her and he called to her. That was always happening to her wherever she went in the city, so she just did what she always did, which was to ignore him. But he didn't like that, so he chased after her and grabbed her by the throat and a few other parts and told her that he was her boyfriend now. Luca feels his face wash into a shade of gray. I shouldn't be telling you all this stuff. Rebecca says, I'm sorry. No, I can handle it, Luca says. You don't have to be sorry. Rebecca picks at a loose orange thread on the seam of her jeans. I haven't been able to talk to anyone about this since it happened. She says, only sold out and she won't speak of it. Luca nods, I understand. Feels like you're my friend, you know. Rebecca smiles. I am, Luca says, and he feels proud. You seem a lot older than you are, like you're this old man in this tiny body. Luca tries to make this a compliment. His body isn't tiny, it's only moderately smaller than a typical 8-year-old. I've seen bad things too, he assures her. Yeah? He nods. I guess you wouldn't be on top of the strain if you hadn't. Es un perquisito, says Luca says. A prerequisite. Rebecca nods. My papi died, he whispers. He hasn't wanted to say those words out loud to admit it. This is the first time he can feel the words. I think it's just like something rotten has broken off inside him and fallen away. This is a ragged wound now, where he'd been holding those words. Oh no, Rebecca says. She leans forward like she's suddenly off balance, but then she touches her forehead against his, and they both close their eyes. The rest of this story emerges in stolen moments over the next several days. How sold out unwanted boyfriend turned out to be the palabrow of the local clique of an international gang. How he was therefore just violent and powerful enough to do whatever he liked to her without fear or present, but not quite violent or powerful enough to preserve all for himself. How Soldad's love quickly deteriorated into a series of lurid traumas. How Soldad confided some of it to Rebecca, but went to extravagant lengths to hide the situation from the baby, because she understood that were he to discover her, his resulting efforts to protect her would get him killed. Rebecca knows that Yvonne, which was the name of the unwanted boyfriend, sometimes allowed Soldad to go to school and sometimes did not, but there is so much she doesn't know. How he always allowed Soledad to go home at night because of the idea of having a curfew served and the depravity of his mind to sustain her future, how her decency, her moral resistance to him, her very obvious loathing all turned him on. How Soledad began to perceive this, she sometimes pretended to enjoy his company in hopes he'd grow tired of her, and how now and then Soledad remembers that pretend enjoyment, she feels flooded with shame. It was futile anyway because that effort of the subterfuge was no match for her beauty. One day, Yvonne showed Soledad a picture of the hotel where her father worked. He said her father's name to her and then gave her a cell phone and instructed her to answer it whenever it rang or beeped, no matter what she was doing. He showed her how to text. It's good to be alive, right, Soledad? He said as she cringed at the way he shortened her name, as if he were someone she loved. During all those weeks of suffering, Soledad, who knew only the flimsy protection she could offer her baby sister, was her unaccustomed distance, barely saw Rebecca at all. When Ivan Yvonne called, Soledad stopped whatever she was doing as instructed, and she went to him. She left her shopping bag in the middle of the aisle or got out of the line where she waited for the bus or lifted herself out of the chair in the middle of her reading class, and she moved across to the city to him like a zombie magnet. Twice Soledad saw Yvonne shoot people in the back of the head. Once she watched him kick a 9-year-old boy in the stomach until he coughed up blood, because that was one of the ways they initiated new chaos into the gang. That day she asked him what would happen if she didn't answer her cell phone sometime, and he backhanded her in the mouth, leaving a bruise along her lower jaw and a welt on her lip that was difficult to explain. Pappy, if I was in the shower or something, she explained to Yvonne afterward, or if my Pappy was there and I couldn't answer. And when she said this, Yvonne cocked back and pretended he was going to hit her again, and Soledad winced and cowered, and Yvonne laughed and said, just answer your phone, puta. And after that, he let one of his homeboys pay him to be alone with her for an hour. Soledad didn't actively want to die, but not really. She'd always been a happy child. She remembered how it felt to be happy, and she wasn't sure she could ever feel that way. She could ever feel that feeling again, but the memory of it provided her with some measure of hope. Still, during that long stretch of weeks with Yvonne, There were plenty of times when it crossed their mind to drag a razor blade across the raised tangle of vessels in her wrist, or to lift the sheet, or to lift the homemade gun from where Ivan placed it on his bedside table before he did what he did to her, to train it on him to pull the trigger, to shoot him and watch his brains splutter satisfyingly against the ceiling above him, and then to turn the gun on herself before his homies could swoop in and punish her, to be done with it all, to be free from his repetitive torture. But then she thought of her baby, the suffering her release would cause him, her Mamie and her brother back home in the cloud forest too, when Papi would have to go home to the mountain place and deliver the news. But more than any of that, so the thought of Rebecca, her sister was afraid but still intact. Rebecca was still undiscovered, and it was the improbable miracle of that trip that kept Solda going, the possibility of her baby sister's salvation. Then one afternoon, Yvonne lay in bed wearing boxer shorts and smoking a cigarette. He blew the smoke towards Solda, where she sat slightly curled over herself on the edge of the bed near his feet. "So I heard you got a sister," he said, nudging her backside with his toe. Solda was very grateful not to be facing him when he said this, because she knew her face would have told the whole story of panic that these words were provoked. "How come you never mentioned her?" Solda was wrapped in a sheet. It was tucked beneath her arms. She made her face into the approximation of a smile and turned it toward him. "We're not close," she said. "She's nothing like me." Outside, she could hear two of Von Homeboys arguing, but there were also children playing somewhere beyond, squealing, chasing one another up the block. The sunlight rocketed through the open window. "Nothing like you, huh?" he said, sitting up and yanking the sheet down to her waist. He tapped the bottom of her breast and watched it react. "That's not what I heard." Then he tossed his still full cigarette into the ashtray beside the bed and sat up on his knees. "Damn girl, let me get in there again." Sol endured him with something more immediate than terrifying than her regular revulsion, and when he was finished and he instructed her to come back in the morning and bring her sister, she went home. Back and took all the little bit of money Pippi had managed to save from the coffee can on top of the refrigerator, and then sat down at the table to wait for Rebecca to get home. She wrote Pippi Carito Pippi. "I love you so, so much, Pippi, and I'm sorry for these words I had to write that I know will break your heart, and I'm sorry for taking all your savings, but I know that you work hard to save this money only for us. I know that you'd assist me take it and use it to get away from here, and if you knew the terrible things that were happening to me and I didn't tell you sooner because I thought I could protect you and Rebecca if I stayed quiet and just did that what they told me to do. But there are monsters in the city, Pippi, and now I'm so scared, and I have to get Rebecca out of here before they hurt her too. So we're leaving today, Pippi. We are already gone, and you must be very careful and look after yourself, please. We are taking with you us in our hearts. And we will call you when we get to El Norte, Pippi, and we will send for you when we have jobs, and you can come to us, and you can bring Mamie and Abuela too, and we will all be together again as it is meant to be. God bless you, Pippi, until we meet again. All my love from your devoted daughter, full of sorrow, Soledad. Much of this Rebecca doesn't know, but she does know that Soledad texted to their cousin Cesar in Maryland that afternoon while she waited for Rebecca to get home. And she knows that Cesar didn't ask any questions because he already knew all the worst possible answers, and all he wanted to do was get them out of there. Rebecca knows that Cesar asked if they could wait for a few days so he could try to arrange for a coyote to bring them all the way from Honduras to El Norte, but Soledad told them they couldn't wait. They were leaving today. Right now, Rebecca knows that Cesar has since paid for their crossing with a trustworthy coyote who will meet them at the border. Rebecca doesn't know that the sum of their money their cousin paid for their crossing was $4,000 each, but even if she had known, that kind of money doesn't even make sense to her. It's so far into the realm of the incomprehensible that it might as well have been $4 million. As Rebecca reveals what scraps of story she does have to Luca, he starts to understand that this is the one thing all Margos have in common. This is all there, that this is among them. They all come from different places, different types of, some urban, some rural, some middle class, some poor, some well-educated, some illiterate, Salvadoran, Honduran, Guatemalan, Mexican, Indian. Each of them carries some story of suffering on top of that trade and into El Norte beyond. Some, like Rebecca, share their stories carefully, selectively finding a faithful ear and chanting their words like prayers. Other migrants are like blown open grenades, telling their anguish compulsively to everyone they meet, dispensing their pain like shrapnel so that they might one day wake to find their burdens have grown lighter. Luca wonders what it would feel like to blow up like that, but for now he remains undetoned, undetonated, his horror sealed tightly inside, his pin fixed snugly in place. Thank you for listening to this chapter. Have a good week and stay safe.